We're in Genesis 14 this morning. My topic is the lessons, or some lessons, in the Valley of Siddim. And there's going to be a lot of names and things in this study. I may pronounce them differently than you do. I'm not judging you if you don't judge me. How about that? We're just going to get through all the names. And I'm going to try to say Siddim. From what I've looked up, it sounds or looks sounds maybe that like it's more Hebrewish. All right? So you can say Siddim, Siddim. I'm going to say Siddim. It's S-I-D-D-I-M, one way or the other. All right? Or at least in the New King James. That's what I'm using this morning. By the way, good morning. You already know who I am. I do bid you wonderful greetings from the Church of Christ and our work in the Northeast area of the Metroplex of San Antonio. Of course, it seems like our cities are growing closer and closer together, and I know our hearts are already there. So thank you very much for being able to speak to you this morning. And thank you for being here. By the way, the handout that you have, we're probably not going to get through all of it. It should be one page front and back. We're just not going to get through it all. I probably have 2 or 3 hours worth of information. I'm not going to keep you here that long. But it will be an assignment to you for whenever you get it finished. It will be homework. You never know when I'm going to ask for it. So, you know, you do have to get it done. In your own personal study, reflect on Genesis 14 and Genesis 19 and how this Valley of Siddim has worked into the plan of God throughout the Bible. I value Bible classes. I have been to congregations that do not have Bible classes for whatever reason. And I think that's a shame. I don't mean to offend. I've learned more in Bible classes throughout my life than possibly any other way. And especially as a teacher, because it forces me to know the material to be able to teach it to others. I really appreciate your attendance here, your family's attendance, wherever you are a member, especially for those who are visiting with us. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, Paul writes to Timothy and says, "Teach other men. As I have taught you, you teach other men who will be able to teach other men also." And there's the idea of a turnover of information from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next that doesn't stop. One of the best ways to do that is Bible classes. So I appreciate you being here this morning. I appreciate the Bible class program wherever you are, wherever I am, throughout the globe. We need to be teaching each other and others who are visiting with us at every chance we have. I've got too many pages here. So you're in front of you. You've got the handout in front of you. What I'm going to do first is I'm going to read through Genesis 14, where we see the Valley of Siddim mentioned 3 times. It's the only 3 times it's mentioned specifically in our text, the Bible. It's not a short chapter, but it's not that long. So at this point, go ahead and turn on your ears to supercharge mode, and I'm going to read through this chapter. If we don't cover the text, there's no way for us to get God's information out of it, for us to have correct exegesis or the right hermeneutic. Basically, what those mean is get what it means out of what's in front of us, the Bible. We need to have text, the context, and make connections with other scriptures. So this is the first step. We're looking at the text. Genesis chapter 14, starting in verse 1. "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these joined together in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim and Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shaveh Kirithaim, and the Horites in their mountain of Seir as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and attacked all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. For he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, brother of the Eshcol and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he gave him a tithe of all. Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons and take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich,' except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their portion." All right, thank you for listening. The big picture, as you'll see on the outline on the back of the worksheet, big picture, Abram goes to war to rescue Lot. And we have a short outline there of Genesis 14. Of course, this is not the end of the story. You know the end of the story if you've read through Genesis, been in our Bible classes, at least in junior high, high school, and college. If you turn five chapters later, you find another mention of cities of the Valley of Siddim. And we're not going to read through Genesis 19 because I've taken a little bit of time doing that. But consider that Sodom and Gomorrah were in this valley. They were conquered in Genesis 14. Actually, they were conquered to begin with, Genesis 14, verses 1 through 4, served these four kings of Mesopotamia for 12 years, and then rebelled in the 13th year. And immediately, in the 14th year, the kings come back and reconquer them. So they've been conquered twice already by verse 12. And then they're rebuilt, repopulated. And then something happens in Genesis 19. God in Genesis 18 comes as an angel with two other persons who are identified as both angels, and they're also identified as men. He comes to Abram and he reveals to Abram what his plan is. "I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because I have heard the cries of their people against them." And that's what happens. Those two angels or men leave and go into Sodom and Gomorrah for the night. They're put up by Lot. And during that night, Lot's house is attacked by the citizens of Sodom. God saves everyone he can. God sends Lot to go to his sons-in-law and daughters, those who are married. Tell them, "You have to get out of the city now. We have to leave right now." And it was as if he was insane. It was as if he was kidding, making a practical joke. They wouldn't leave. Lot takes everyone he's got, his wife, his two daughters that have not been married, and they leave. Right then, right there. They leave to Zoar, which was supposed to be destroyed, but he asked for that city to be the place where he would go instead of the mountains. And in the morning, Abraham is looking, and he's looking down on the Valley of Siddim. And initially, the Valley of Siddim, all right, going back to Genesis 14, the Valley of Siddim is beautiful and it's rich. If you have maps in the back of your Bible, I don't have a PowerPoint, but if you have maps in the back of your Bible, you're going to see that Mount Hermon, the springs of Mount Hermon, the tallest mountain in the area, in the north, the springs of Mount Hermon feed the Jordan River, and it goes into the Sea of Galilee, and then you're going to see this blue line come down from the Sea of Galilee, and it's the Jordan River, all the way down to, and what is in our maps is a big blue lake. It's huge. It's bigger than the Sea of Galilee. It's called the Dead Sea. In Genesis 14:3, we have a huge contrast. We have the Valley of Siddim, which would have been the delta of the Jordan River. Imagine for yourself great beauty. If you've been to Jamaica, raise your hand. All right. Okay. Did you ever eat at the Ruins restaurant around Ocho Rios? Did you ever go through Fern Gully? Think of those sights in your mind. That's relatively accurate for what the Valley of Siddim would have been. The Jordan River running into it and watering it. And it would be absolutely beautiful and rich. Because Sodom and Gomorrah were rich. They were worth these four kings coming from Mesopotamia. Tell you what, take your hand with me. I'm not going to have time to do this a different way. You may stand if you wish. This is the interactive part of the lesson. Take your, it's my left hand, so it would be your right hand, off to your right of your head. All right, above your head. This is Mesopotamia. This is where the four kings are coming from. They're coming down, all right, past Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is about the top of your head or your forehead. All right, Mount Hermon is a very tall place. I'm not saying your forehead is sticking out. All right, so Mount Hermon, they come down and they're following the king's highway, as it were. All right, and it's a path. It's not a highway, not a road like the Romans would know. But they're a few miles off to the east of the Jordan River, and they're following it parallel. All right, paralleling the Jordan River as they come down. They come down to the Sea of Galilee and they take over Ashtaroth and Carnaim. In Gilead. Then they come down to Ham, all right, that's around your chin area, all right? And then they're going to take over cities down further around, but not in the Valley of Siddim yet, all right? So that's your chest area. Or we're going to keep on going. And down by your belly, that's El Paran, all right, probably on the Gulf of Aqaba. They come back up on the other side and take over Kadesh Barnea. And Shaveh Kirathaim, all right, the plain of Kirathaim. They come up to En Mishpat. We would know that today as En Gedi, all right? And that's a wonderful place, beautiful place for people to go and check out the Dead Sea and a nice resort place there in En Gedi. Beautiful. Maybe what's left of the beauty of the Valley of Siddim. And then when they took over in Hazazon Tamar, which we would call En Gedi, verses 5 through 7, then the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah went out and went to war against them and lost. Right. They didn't have to cross the Dead Sea because it wasn't there. What God did in Genesis 19 was what the kings of Mesopotamia could not do. They could not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah enough to get rid of the sin. God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah such that in the morning when Lot and his daughters woke up, and when Abram was looking back at the beautiful Valley of Siddim, what they saw was blackened earth, probably deepened by the fire that God sent to destroy it. It would have been smoking, and that's all that's left. All the trees are gone. All the grass is gone. the Jordan River that watered this whole area. The Valley of Siddim, or Valley of Fields. All right, Siddim means fields or flat places. So it was a large area. It was both a valley, and yet there were flat places in it. What God did was He destroyed it to the point that it could not be rebuilt. And here, when you look at a map, you look for Sodom and Gomorrah. And the Dead Sea has a little jut out into it, all right, about two-thirds of the way south on the eastern shore. It has a name. I think it's the Lisan is what it's named. That's probably where Sodom was, except it's about 200 or 300 feet down at this point. It's all surrounded by water that is more salty than Corpus Christi's water, than Virginia Beach's water. Wherever you go to the beach, wherever you go to get to some salt water, some beautiful coastline, that's 38,000 parts per million salt. That's seawater. The Dead Sea is much more than that. Where did that salt come from? Well, someone looked back as they were fleeing the city in the night, as God was sending down fire to destroy the cities. Who was that? Lot's wife. Luke 17, verse 32. Remember Lot's wife. Why? Because she looked back at sin. She wanted it back. She missed it. And it wasn't necessarily just a glance. It was more like a gaze. She became a pillar of salt. Now, the Jordan River is fresh water. Where did the salt come from? There's not necessarily, or at least we have no record of any like underground pit that would bring the Mediterranean Sea's salt water inland to the Dead Sea. Now, maybe some of that salt came with the fires that God sent to destroy the cities. I'm thinking that very possibly Lot's wife was not just human size as a pillar of salt. If that water of the Dead Sea became more salty than any regular salt water of any ocean on earth, the pillar of salt that she became probably was tens, maybe hundreds of feet tall. There's a lot of salt in that water. You will naturally float on that water. You have to put weights on your ankles to go underneath the water. That's how dense that water is today. God destroyed these cities. And not only did He destroy them with fire. All right, and we read of this happening in Joshua. God told Joshua, destroy this city and this city with fire. Not only are you to kill everyone in the city because they're so evil, but they have cursed their own land so bad, I don't want this rebuilt. You take fire and you destroy this city. Not only did God destroy them with fire, He salted it with Lot's wife. Anyone ever try to, instead of the parable of the sower spreading seed, you ever spread salt on land? I think the only time we do that is to get the ice off the roads, right? If you salt land, what happens to it? Can you grow regular crops that we normally look for, that we normally get food from? No. You salt that land and it will not grow your normal crops. It will not grow your wheat, your corn, right? Am I right? Call me out if I'm wrong. God destroyed those cities with fire and with salt. Nothing would grow there ever again. And what's there today is called the Dead Sea. Genesis 14, verse 3, Moses makes this contrast. The Valley of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. An extreme contrast. Now the question is, why? Why did this beautiful, beautiful place get destroyed multiple times and finally by God? One three-letter word. Starts with S. It's sin. One word, sin. All right. As usual, I'm running out of time, but I wasn't supposed to say that. The Valley of Siddim was beautiful and rich to begin with in Genesis 14. In their rebellion, Sodom and Gomorrah completely underestimated the four kings and their will and ability to reconquer them. The only reason why you would go hundreds of miles with tens of thousands of soldiers is if you're going to get something that's worth the effort. All right? That's how I know the Valley of Siddim was beautiful and rich, because four kings from the Euphrates and the Tigris came all the way down to this area just to conquer this valley. Did you notice they kept it last? They didn't attack it first, they kept it last. So when their soldiers were most tired of fighting, the greatest prize was at the end. You need an incentive to fight, give the greatest prize at the end. And that's when they attacked Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's make a spiritual application of this first point. Are we considering the adversary and his will against us? You're worth something. And you're worth something not just to God who created you. You're worth something not just to Jesus Christ who died for you. You're also worth something to Satan, because he's constantly trying to get you. He won't stop. He wants your soul. He wants you to sin so he can have you destroyed. You're worth something. Don't take Satan for granted. Don't underestimate the devil. 1 Peter 5, verse 8, he's a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He's trying to consume you. Don't let him win. The leaders of Sodom and Gomorrah failed their people, physically and spiritually. Spiritually, we know, because they led them in the sin. Physically, did I read that right? Or during the battle, did these kings of Sodom and Gomorrah get stuck in some asphalt pits that were in their own valley? They hadn't gotten outside their cities enough to know the valley around them. They were so worked up in the sin in their own cities, and evidently the riches that they had, they didn't even know their own surroundings. How do you fight against a superior force when you don't even know where the asphalt pits are? Now, maybe they were fleeing so much they couldn't think. But wouldn't you avoid traps like that if you're trying to defend your people and yourself? They didn't know the area around them. You must know your surroundings as a Christian in this life. Don't take Satan lightly. Don't take your surroundings lightly. Know your surroundings. Right? God told Abraham in Genesis 13, verses 14 through 17. We won't turn there and read. God told Abram, go into this land that I've given you. Yes, Lot chose the more rich land towards Sodom. And then God told Abram, go and learn this land. You be a nomad, and you go throughout this land of Canaan. I'm going to give you and your posterity behind, your family after you. And you know this land. You find out what it is and where things are. You get to know this place because it's the promised land. It's what I've promised you. Abraham knew his land. By the way, we didn't finish our little interactive presentation. Take your other hand, all right, and off to the west. That would be your left. There's Hebron around your chest area, all right? And that's probably where Abram was when he found out about Lot being taken with Sodom and Gomorrah. Abram doesn't sit there and do nothing. Abram does something about this problem. He gets 318 trained servants who were born in his own household. He didn't have to go out and hire people. He already had them. Abram's rich. He's rich. He's got servants, slaves, and they follow him and they fight for him. He goes from Hebron area, all right, called Mamre here in Genesis 13 and 14, and he goes up to Dan. Dan is around your forehead area, all right, at the foot of Mount Hermon. And then He attacks the four kings at night. Whoa. Wait a minute. This is almost 4,000 years ago. And Abraham is attacking at night. That's impressive to me. That's impressive. Anyone remember the videos in 1992 or 1993? Desert Storm? When we started bombing Iraq at midnight. And we actually, I stayed up and saw the bombs and the tracers and things. And it was just boom, 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 boom. It was like, wow, that's amazing. All right? That's what Abram did. Abram caught up with these four kings and all their spoils. Going back to the Euphrates and Tigris area, the Mesopotamia, he caught up to them and attacked them at night in the mountains. And he didn't stop once they started running. He kept on continuing to fight and to kill them for about 40 miles up to this area called Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He didn't let them get back to their homeland, by the way. He fought them as they fled. But wait, these are the four kings that just took over all these places around. Abram, how are you winning? How is Abram winning? God is with him. God is with him. And throughout your Bible, you see the history of Israel and other nations. And when God is fighting for Israel, what happens? Israel wins. When God is fighting for Judah, what happens? Judah wins. It doesn't matter what the odds are. It doesn't matter if you're Gideon's 300 against 300,000. Or in another place, it's 185,000. And they kill themselves. When God fights for you, you win. The question is, are you on God's side? And thus, is God on your side? That's the big question. But like I said, we're not going to get through all this. The leaders of Sodom and Gomorrah failed their people, both spiritually and physically. When you consider Lot, I've got a list of all these verses that I wanted read. I'm going to jump to the end, and I'm going to come back. Brother Kerry Hooper, would you mind reading for us 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 7 and 8?
But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are preserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as a thousand years.
And this happens from time to time. I make a mistake. This has happened before. I actually need, sorry, and this is my mistake, not yours, 2 Peter 2, verses 7 and 8. I gave you the wrong chapter, brother. I'm sorry. If you wouldn't mind reading verses 7 and 8 of 2 Peter chapter 2. Yes, sir.
Sodom and Gomorrah. Make sure I'm starting to level.
And six is fine too.
Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemn them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly and deliberate righteous lives. Who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwells among them.
Thank you. Thank you very much, especially for covering for my error there. We have several lessons, both generally for the church and for elders and preachers. I'm going to start with elders and preachers. Whether you're in the promised land or whether you're surrounded by the wicked, be immovable. Immovable. Always abounding in the work of the Lord, right? 1 Corinthians 15:58. Abram was righteous. We know that from Hebrews. We'll read that in just a moment. Hebrews chapter 11. Lot also was righteous. That was just read for us, 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. Lot was righteous. His family was the righteous, surrounded by the wicked. That may be you at some point in your life. You may find yourself being the righteous one, surrounded by the wicked. Be immovable. Stay on God's side. It's worth it. You will be persecuted. You will be made fun of. You will be mocked. Things will be much more difficult for you than for everybody else, and that's not fair. Stay immovable. Because you are the salt of the earth. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 15. You are the preservative. Maybe you're the one keeping God from destroying those people. You're the one that is sent into that wicked area to give them some preservative of the gospel. And maybe you will win one or two or three or 20 or 100. That was Lot. He was righteous. Not perfect, but righteous. Abram was also righteous. Lot's family was a righteous surrounded by the wicked. I can't get away from this. I've got to say this, though. If you're surrounded by the wicked, don't trust them with your daughters. None of them. They're not worth it. They won't listen to you at 2 o'clock in the morning when you say, we've got to get out of town. Because God's going to destroy this place. They didn't listen to Lot in Genesis 19. They won't listen to you. Consider... Consider who and the process in your own study. Go to Genesis 24 and parallel that with Genesis 19. Genesis 19, Lot gave two of his oldest daughters to the men of Sodom and Gomorrah because that's where they were. All right, I'm sure that's the men that are available. All right, try to pick some of the best or the worst, you know. How did Abraham get a wife for his son Isaac? He sent his best servant, his most trusted servant. He made a covenant with that servant and made him promise, you don't go get a daughter of these Amorites in whose land I dwell. You go back to Haran. You go back to my extended family and you get one of Isaac's effectively cousins, right? But different time, different culture. But he's looking for something. What is he looking for? He's looking for faithfulness. He's looking for godliness, as it will become, in the wife for Isaac. And Genesis 24 is a whole extended repetition of what Abraham told his servant to do. He knows it verbatim. When he gets to Haran, he didn't write it down necessarily, but he knows exactly what his master told him word for word. And he says, this is what I've got to do. Just amazing. That was free. God's judgment, punishment, destruction, and yet salvation. God saved the righteous out of Sodom and Gomorrah. The lessons for this morning. Earth is the scene of a great war. Just like the Valley of Siddim, Earth, the whole earth, is the scene of a great war. And it's us against sin. Now, on one hand, you could say God versus Satan. That's true. But if you're not fighting sin, sin is beating you. You have no choice but to fight it. Especially if you want to go to the promised land, which is not just Canaan. For us, it's heaven. Yes? Our living hope, incorruptible, reserved in heaven for you. 1 Peter chapter 1. Earth is the scene of a great war. Christians, will we be like Abram and win back our brother when they've been taken hostage by sin? Galatians chapter 6 verses 1 and 2. You send someone who is spiritual. Those who are spiritual among you, go after those who are lost in sin and bring them back. James chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. If you win him back, you will have covered a multitude of sins. That's what God wants. Luke chapter 15, verses 7 and 10. Can you hear the angels? The angels are singing in heaven at the foot of God's throne when one person repents and comes back to Jehovah. More than 99 of us who don't need any penitence. God wants our hearts. He wants those who are lost to come back. Why did Jesus come to the earth? Luke chapter 19, verse 10. When he's talking to Zacchaeus, the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. That's why Jesus came. That's why we're here. God's presence. Sin costs something. And one of the things that it costs is God's presence, His providence, and His protection. And we can see that in Sodom and Gomorrah, the Valley of Siddim, this morning. We can see that in 2 Kings chapter 17 when he allows the 10 tribes of Israel to be taken over by Assyria. We can see that in 2 Kings 24 and 25 in 606 BC when Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Why, God, would you allow this capital city to fall to the evil, the wicked? Because you could teach them how to sin. That's the answer. You are sinful. You are my people, and you are more sinful than they are. Sin generates pride. We go to 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, and we say that pride is a sin, and that's true. But also it's kind of circular, because the more I sin, the more I think I'm okay to sin. The more I think I'm getting away with it, the better I get at lying to cover it and acting like somebody else instead of who I should be to get out of the problem, to get out of the consequences. It doesn't work. It comes for you. The truth gets revealed. Let me get some verses. Well, I'm sorry. I did assign some verses and I'm running out of time. And that's normal for me. Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 through 19. Dad, if you wouldn't mind reading that. Where are you? I'm sorry, go ahead.
And unto Adam, he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and eaten of the tree, of which I have commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In toil thou shalt eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it thou wast taken, and for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return.
Thank you. Man's sin is a curse on the earth. What that means is, okay, God created this earth and everything here. And everything outside the earth, everything physical was made for you and me. Everything. You know how I know that? We were made on day six. We were the last creation. We were made in the image of God. Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27, and verse 31 and 2, verse 7. God breathed into man the breath of life, and he became a living being, a living soul. He was made in the image of man, given a spirit. Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. You're different than everything else God has ever made because you're like Him. You're made like God. Everything else physical is to support you. Mankind is not a curse upon the earth. Mankind is the blessing that the earth supports until we sin. And at the point of sin, that becomes a curse, not just to yourself, not just to the people around you. By the way, it always affects more people than just one. There is no victimless sin. And God curses the earth because of man's sin. Genesis 3, verses 17 through 19. You can read through Genesis 13, Genesis 14, Genesis 19. And let me jump to another thought. We're worried about being green these days, being environmentally conscious. And that's a good thing because we're stewards of this earth and of God's creation. But yes, we are at the top of God's creation. The worst, the utterly worst environmental disasters ever done are recorded right here in our Bibles in the book of Genesis. Follow them with me. Genesis chapter 3. Man was banished out of the best place on earth, the Garden of Eden. Why? Because of sin. Genesis 6 through 8, God destroyed everything on land of His creation except what was in the ark that Noah built. Everything on land died. Why? Sin. You want to talk about an environmental disaster? I'm not talking a 3-year drought. Hello, Central Texas, right? And I'm not talking about a 500-year flood either, localized in its origin. Hello, Central Texas, yes? I'm talking about a global flood on the earth for a year so that everything on land dies. That's what God did. That's Genesis 6 through 8. By the way, He's going to do it again, but not with water, with
fire.
2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 13. By the way, I've run out of time. 2 Peter chapter 3, on your own, read these verses. I had them assigned, I had them assigned to you, got out of it. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 13, read that on your own. You'll know that God is going to destroy this earth and everything with it. Everything that He created physically is made for the end of fire. And thus, how should we live? If the physical is going to be destroyed, how should you live? You put your priorities straight and you put heaven first. You put God's will first. Man's sin is a curse on the earth. Sin costs God's presence. Sin generates pride. Earth is the scene of great war. It matters who you serve. It matters who you serve. You have to choose who you serve, God or Satan. It matters. Throughout your life, not just this life, but the next life. Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 24. Are you going to set down roots here on earth? Or are you going to be a sojourner? Lot set down roots and it cost him. It cost him too much to maintain those roots. He wasn't ready to go when it was time to go. Abram lived as a sojourner, as a nomad. He learned the land and yet he was mobile. He was moving, he was flexible. Be a sojourner. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 9 and 10. Do we seek the beauty of earth? This is a beautiful place. No matter where you're from, there's beauty, isn't there? Do we seek the beauty of earth or the beauty of heaven? Those are two very different animals. By the way, this earth and the life on earth is no paradise. 2 Peter 3, Colossians 3, verses 1 and 2. Set your mind on things above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God, where you will be if you're faithful to God. And God uses the faithful. Be immovable. Elders and preachers, be a catalyst. Be a support for the people that you're serving, the members of your congregations. Don't get in their way in their quests of faithful obedience. Lift them up, support them, guide them, right? The worst thing we can do as leaders is get in the way. One of the worst things we can do is get in the way of members who are doing good work. I hope this has been fun. I hope it's been educational. By the way, I knew we wouldn't get through the whole handout. It's for your homework. There is an assignment at the bottom and a challenge. I don't want to leave without saying these things. You study and write down some ways to live as a sojourner here on earth. Look at Genesis 13, verses 14 through 18. And to long for our home in heaven. Colossians 3, verses 1 and 2. Challenge. Be like Lot. Confront sin even when it surrounds you. Be a judge for righteousness. Who did God send to Sodom and Gomorrah to turn them to righteousness by being a judge? God sent Lot. Interesting thought, huh? Be like Abram. Fearlessly pursue your brethren who have been taken hostage by sin. Thank you very much.